We learned about ancient mythology when we were kids. At a bare minimum, it helps to understand how the planets got their names, Mars and Venus and all that. Those two names offer great examples of what we're about to talk about, too. In older polytheistic religions, we had the masculine and the feminine, Venus and Mars. In monotheism, God, the God, is a masculine figure. Our next guest notices and takes exception. Dr. Karen Garst calls herself the faithless feminist. She writes and speaks of expunging the feminine from the divine, and we'll talk about that very subject later today at 2:30 at the library at Southern Oregon University. She stops by the studio to give us a little preview here. Dr. Garst, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So the faithless feminist, is the term self-applied?
Well, let me first say I was invited here in the context of Dr. Marianne Golding's Advanced French Culture class on women and marriage in France. So I do appreciate her invitation, and that is why I'm speaking this afternoon. The faithless feminist, well, let me back up a little. Mm-hmm. I got involved in this. You would think once you're retired, you just go and read novels and things.
But that's the hope, anyway.
I've done a bit of that. But in June of 2014, the United States Supreme Court, in its decision Burwell versus Hobby Lobby, decided that a privately held company didn't need to offer birth control to its employees. And for this second wave feminist, I got very upset with that, and I decided to write a book. And the book is a compilation of essays of women who have left religion and their stories. And when I started to do that, I decided to do some research. So I, you know, went back to the Paleolithic and looked at the image of women in religion from the early goddesses on. And it was really interesting what I found.
What did you find?
Well, most people would agree that, as you said earlier, early religions had a pantheon of gods and goddesses. As you said, Venus, Mars, etc. And there were a lot of Greek gods, and the Romans just renamed them. They were a bit lazy. But even before that, in the Paleolithic, we find a lot of figurines that are, the majority of them are female. Now, there would be some people who have said, well, this is a mother goddess. I don't know that we can go that far. But clearly there was veneration of the female long, long before monotheism. So what I did was take a look at those and read up on some of the women in the 1960s who came into the field of ancient history and archaeology and did more examination of those. And then look at, well, what happened with monotheism? And it was really a fascinating study.
So how much can we know, though? When you talk about Paleolithic societies, it's not like other than the figurines and some cave art, I gather, that we can know a whole lot. It's not like there's a written record of what the beliefs were.
Well, that's true. And I don't know we could call it religion. I think later on, you can see in some of these early excavations of houses that there was a little place there, maybe an inset where you find, particularly in Israel, you will find these, they're called clay pillars. And they're very small. I had the opportunity, I was in London at the British Museum in May, and saw them. And they're about 3 inches tall, but they're women. So some kind of cult there certainly venerated a woman. And if you think about Paleolithic and how precarious life was and how little they knew that the woman had the child. They didn't necessarily, and we don't know how early on they figured out which man was responsible for that child. And there's some early thought that it was the man that created, you know, the heritage of that child. But so it's natural to develop some kind of matrilineal system where we know the child belongs to that mother. We may not know they belong to that father. And certainly having a child continued the tribe and was very essential. So some kind of veneration of that process would seem natural. But of course, you're right. We're not going to know what they believed, whether they thought that was some divine until much later than that.
But you do bring up some names in your work. I mean, you bring up the name of the Canaanite goddess Asherah. I mean, was she anything like the god of the Old Testament?
Well, this is much later. Mm-hmm. So if we want to look at the Iron Age, we will see when the Israelites came into Canaan, and there's not a lot of evidence for them coming from Egypt and the Exodus and all of that. But however they got there, and I think one of the latest theories is that there was a lot of conflict in the seaports, and they may have been there and then went to the hill country because it wasn't occupied. But when they got to Canaan, there clearly was worship of Asherah, which is a goddess. And you can see that in the Bible. They talk about the tree or the pole that represented Asherah. And Asherah is actually a word that can refer to the goddess, and it can refer to that tree and pole as well. They will talk about the high places in Bethel. Well, those all represent Asherah. And you'll see a lot of diatribes against the worship of the female in the Old Testament.
Really? Right in the Old Testament there it says, do not worship the female gods.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And you will see there's some, there's a passage that I'm going to talk about this afternoon in my presentation where there are women who are saying, we're not going to do what you say. When we worship the Queen of Heaven, we had food and everything was going well, and now you substitute this male god and everything's going poorly. So we're going to go back to what we did before. And that is a quotation from the Bible. So clearly there was, even in the record that we have today, a conflict and difficulty imposing this one God. But if you want to back up a little, monotheism in Israel wasn't the first imposition of a male God. If you look at in Mesopotamia, you have a much earlier myth called Enuma Elish. And this is where the god Marduk, who there were a lot of gods, and he wanted to be head god. So he says, hey, look, guys, you let me be the head honcho, and I'll kill that nasty female god Tiamat. And the other gods agree, and he goes, okay, great. And he cuts her up. And by cutting her up, he creates the earth and the skies. Well, there's a very similar passage in Job 41 where Yahweh is fighting the Leviathan, which is a sea monster, and creates the heavens and the sky, the skies and the earth, and makes a division. So there's a lot of similarities going on. But that elevation of the male god occurred even before the imposition of monotheism in the Jewish religion.
All right, polytheism and monotheism, the feminine and the masculine, and expunging the feminine from the divine is the topic of what Dr. Karen Garst talks about, and she'll be talking about it again today at 2:30 at the Mies Meeting Room in the Hannon Library at Southern Oregon University. You can talk about this with us now on The Exchange. 800-838-3760 is the phone number. The email address is jx@jeffnet.org. There's a bit of a journey in your own life, I understand, in reaching a point where you call yourself the faithless feminist. You were a person of faith. You're now an atheist.
Yes. I was raised as a Lutheran in Bismarck, North Dakota. And at that point in time, everybody belonged to a church. I could tell you in my grade school which church everyone went to. And I will tell you a short story. I was in first grade, and the cutest guy walked me home. He was Catholic. And I went to my dad that evening, and I said, Dad, do you think a Lutheran could marry a Catholic? And my dad, in his wisdom, said, you know, marriage is a little difficult. Perhaps you should stay in the faith. And both my sister and I married lapsed Catholics.
Really?
But, yeah, I've been atheist for a couple decades.
But it was Lutheran upbringing, Lutheran college, the whole nine yards. You were fully committed as a Lutheran.
Yes.
Yeah. What undid you?
Well, actually.
Or undid it for you, whichever way you prefer that question to be phrased.
In the 90s, I started to read the works of the Jesus Seminar, and these were a group of scholars, New Testament scholars, who said, well, what about the historical Jesus? What do we know? What could he have said? And they actually went through the New Testament and voted, and black and red. In fact, on the cover of Time magazine in 1996, they were featured. And I read I read several of their books because I was interested. And I read a book by Bishop Spong called Resurrection, Myth or Reality.
I've interviewed him here, yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. After I read that book, I said, okay, there really wasn't a resurrection. And that was the last little thing for me. My husband and I did attend a church that was loosely called a church. It's a Living Enrichment Center in Wilsonville. It was New Thought. My mother-in-law, who's a devout Catholic, said after hearing the preacher speak once, she said, well, that was a nice speech. I wouldn't call it a sermon. And then when that folded, we drifted away completely.
I noticed at your website, The Faithless Feminist, that you point out that you could have kept the decision to cease religion, to essentially give up on the idea of higher powers. You could have kept it to yourself, but you decided to go public with it. What was the thinking there?
Well, the reason I did that, because I was very disturbed about the Supreme Court decision in Hobby Lobby. I'm what you call a second-wave feminist. I came of age in the 60s and 70s, and the changes that were wrought there are just phenomenal. I mean, not just reproductive rights, but looking about women having all the rights of men, whether it's property, divorce, child custody, and so that was very important to me, and yet I see us drifting back. And all the discussion, if you look at the debates, particularly on the presidential debates on the Republican side, they're talking about taking those rights away. And I think it's very important for me and for other women who are feminists to speak out and to preserve those rights for young people. And I think it's religion. I would say religion is the last cultural barrier to gender equality.
Now, the Hobby Lobby case itself is particularly noteworthy because it was was it feeling strongly held, religious feelings closely held? There was some particular key wording in one of the briefs that came out of the Supreme Court about that. But essentially, carving out a place for people to say that practicing their religion then leads them to take this position on the reproductive rights of their workers.
Yes. Hobby Lobby, I don't think it would work with a publicly traded company. There's a distinction there, but Hobby Lobby is a privately held corporation.
Closely held corporation, that's right.
Closely held, yes. Mm-hmm. And because of that, there's a little niche there, and they said their religious beliefs, they don't want to provide certain forms of birth control that they consider abortifacients. That was a decision, and I might point out that the five justices who decided in favor were all people who had noted themselves as Catholics.
And when you say abortifacients, I should point out, we're not talking about the actual operation of abortion. We're talking about just like the morning after pill, essentially.
The morning after pill, and there is some discussion about IUDs and other things like that they oppose.
Dr. Karen Garst, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She calls herself the Faithless Feminist. She talks and writes about expunging the feminine from the divine, and we'll talk about that today at 2:30 at the library at Southern Oregon University in the Mies Meeting Room. She's here now to talk to about religion, monotheism, and polytheism, and particularly about the women getting essentially kicked out of the pantheon. Join us on the Exchange with your questions, comments, observations, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So when you look back in history at places where the feminine figures got nudged to the side, was it a wholesale change of a religion replacing a religion in a particular part of the world, or was it sometimes a change within a religion, I wonder?
Well, I think it's a long-term development. I think culture changes slowly. And there may have been some instances of monotheism earlier, but I think we really credit the Jewish religion and that tradition for creating monotheism. And, of course, today we have three monotheistic religions. And I think if you trace that history, you look at eliminating the feminine from the divine, what was the impact on women? And whether you take the Old Testament or follow that through, I mean, women weren't part of the divine. They were considered unclean. And you get into the Christianity and St. Augustine, my goodness, you know, it's the original sin, it's women's fault. And the things that have happened because of that, whether it's witches and murdering witches or preventing women from owning property, or there's just an incredible number of things that women had been disadvantaged, I believe, because of religion.
Now, you point out in your work that there are in some other ancient religions stories of trees of knowledge and apples and snakes and the whole works, but told very differently. Give us an example.
Well, for example, and this is a way that culture really is pervasive. In Greek, the word hygeia is our word for hygiene, which is health. And the symbol for that goddess, Hygeia, is a snake. Well, what is the symbol today for medical doctors?
The snake.
The caduceus, mm-hmm. The snake. And in Egyptian, the word or the symbol for goddess is the cobra. So snake was associated with women. As I said earlier, Asherah, the pole or the tree. So what better way to put down women in Genesis than portraying a snake as the bad guy, as a tree of knowledge, as something that Eve wants to partake of? All of that symbolism is a way of putting down the goddess and women.
So a deliberate thing, certainly not like just like, hey, we feel this way. You're talking about this as a calculated move.
Absolutely.
All right, we have a couple calls. Grab your headphones. Let's talk first to Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Karen Garst.
Karen, this is phenomenal. It's like I want to. I'm voting for a five-hour show with you.
You're sweet. You just made my day.
Yeah, good thing. What the two questions or two approaches that I'd like to add, and I'm sure this is nothing new to you. The difference between spirituality and religion, as spirituality as living in a relationship, in a meaningful relationship with everything, versus religion as being in charge of. Okay. Now, if we let this sit here and we go to the other, to the actual bottom line of where the patriarchal religion comes from, and which is natural resource control. And woman becomes a natural resource that needs to be controlled. Instead of having a relationship with a woman, you want to control her because she's the life giver, and you as the male can't fix that by any means you want. You can make bleeding unclean, you can make the whole reproductive process igidigid, but you cannot control that life resource.
Well, are you sure you don't want to come do my presentation with me? Because I think you're very, you're right up my alley. Obviously, a lot of this started with the property. If you look back at hunter-gatherer societies, they were much more egalitarian. Their hunter-gatherer societies that anthropologists study today are much more egalitarian. But once agriculture started, then you've got property. And it's my field. It's not your field. I want to control it. And you get starting with small villages, etc., and then somebody has to be in charge. And the other thing about religion, it allows you to say, they're not us. So if you have a group of people who believe in a certain way, a certain God, then it's much easier to kill the other people who don't believe the same thing. So clearly what you said is true. Religion is about power. It's about control. And in the case of women, it's a way to dominate women. And women were considered property. Clearly, if you read the Old Testament, and certainly before that, too. And even before monotheism, women weren't considered equal. But in monotheism, they are dirty, they are unclean, and they are the prizes you get in war. They can be bought and sold. They have no rights, etc. So you're absolutely right.
Wolfgang, thanks for that. Let's go to Brad in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Karen Garst.
Yeah, thanks. This is right up my field because I have a master's degree in divinity from a seminary at the University of Chicago. And when I was there, I was interested in Carl Jung especially. And reading Jung, he pointed out something that was so obvious it was astonishing. And that is that in all of Christendom, there is no feminine element represented as, divine and so forth, other than in the Catholic religion. And they have Mother Mary. She was a virgin, evidently, they say. So there's a real exclusion of women from the whole realm of religion in our Christian heritage, and yet we have a male God. And when people try to change the gender on that, people got upset, and you should say his and so forth. So she's right on, and I'm very comfortable with her atheism. I respect atheists as being moral, ethical people as well as other religious types. So thanks for that. I'm looking forward to hearing her presentation today.
All right. Thanks for that, Brad.
I would just like to make one comment. I think you pointed out something that's very accurate, which is let's talk about the Virgin Mary. Now, it's true that the Catholic Church venerates the Virgin Mary, and over time, over 2,000 years, has raised her up with the Assumption and the Ascension and all of that kind of stuff. But it's very interesting the role she plays. Number one, virgin mother. Okay, none of us can imitate that. So it's really not a standard that I would say is good for women. And second of all, you know, I believe it's the second commandment forbids graven images, but Pope Gregory in the 6th century had to change that because everybody was illiterate, and the only way they could teach their religion was through images. And one of the images they have is the Madonna and Son. But you go back to Egypt, you have Isis and her son Horus. So you're continuing that. And I think one of the reasons that the Virgin Mary is venerated in the Catholic Church, because the women said, we need something, give us something. And that's what we got.
Okay, final call here from Shirley in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Karen Garst.
Hi, I just wanted to point out that some of the books that changed my mind on this were by Rhianne Eisler, The Chalice and the Blade and Sacred Pleasures. And what they talk about is getting rid of all of the places where we used to worship the goddesses and taking those same sacred sites and making them churches and mosques and places that women could no longer claim as their own spiritual source.
Thank you for that.
And that's accurate. I've read one of her books, and she continues to speak out. She's a very good author and writer.
So you're obviously not presenting this just as a historical curiosity. What do you hope people do with the information you impart in pointing out the expunging of the feminine from the divine?
Well, and I want to be clear, I'm not don't want to go back to a goddess religion. I'm doing this presentation, as I said, based on a request by Dr. Golding, and it's a lot of the research I've done. But what I'm really want people to understand is that women... that this is a religion is a culture barrier to equality. And I have a book that's going to be published in the fall. It's called Women Beyond Belief, Discovering Life Without Religion. And it's women from all ages, all different faiths. So if a woman is there on that border and wonders if she can do it, can she leave religion, get the book, read it. You know, there's a lot of other women like you, and join us.
Dr. Karen Garst calls herself the faithless feminist. She'll be talking about expunging the feminine from the divine this afternoon at 2:30 at the Meese Room at the library at Southern Oregon University, brought in by Dr. Marianne Golding. Thank you so much for joining us, Karen Garst.
Thank you.